sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
Actually, in the end of the day, we're kind of being forced, some people much more uncomfortably than others, because they don't even have separate spaces, privacies that some other people are afforded. And a lot of bosses who might have the two houses, six cars, and, you know, need to lean in with empathy on others who might not have the same kind of conditions, whether it's marital bliss or a beautiful home with three different rooms that you can hide off in if you need to. This notion of actually work and personal life have merged in this pandemic. And I think that's a good thing, because it's waking people up to the fact that being two different people is bad news.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. Now, that is Minter Dial. And Minter's the author of a book titled You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. Now, it's not going to surprise you that I liked Minter's book, because I often talk on this show about how being yourself is the key to making you a better seller. In our conversation, we talk about how in the wake of the pandemic, people are rethinking and reconfiguring what's important. And as Minter advocates in his book, it's time for a radically different way to think and act in leadership and in sales, which at heart is fundamentally a leadership activity. Success requires that you be you, that you accept your own vulnerabilities and embrace the messiness that are personal relationships. And the way you lead and the way you sell is at heart about a human-first leadership. So we dig into how our personal and professional worlds all of a sudden, even before the pandemic and now after, have become much more intertwined, and what that means for how you lead and how you sell. All this and much, much more. Before we get to Minter, though, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could also give us your feedback about how we're doing in the form of a review. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it. Minter, welcome to the show.
Andy, thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure. So you're joining us from where today?
London, England.
Ah, London, England. Yeah. Yeah, we talked a little bit before we got started about you're taking a trip. You're actually escaping lockdown.
That is the idea, you know?
Yeah. That's good. A little Switzerland sounds like a good idea. Now, from reading your book, and we're going to talk about your book, I think it's in your book you talk about it, but it might have been something else I'd read about you. We share something in common, as we're both passionate Liverpool Football Club supporters.
Holy smokes. You'll never walk alone.
You never walk alone. So you'll get the white glove treatment for me.
Oh, thank you.
Show. I mean, if you're an Arsenal supporter, Chelsea, Man U, it might be a little different, but you know.
Red since 1972 here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think I became a fan during the Steve McManaman era.
Oh,
so
nice.
90s. We didn't get a lot of, you know, Premier League then, or, you know, slightly before Premier League football in the U.S. at that time. So, but when I saw him, yeah, he was my favorite player at that time.
Oh, he had a way of running at people with the ball. Boy, was that sexy.
Yeah, there was one particular game match, I can't remember what it was, where he basically went the length of the field, ran through the entire opposing team with the ball at his feet. The score goal is, yeah, pretty spectacular. So, Well, good. Well, we're going to talk about your book. Thank you for joining us. Your book titled You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. And I mean, not to simplify things too much, but I mean, you sort of had in a book sort of springs from an epiphany you had, it sounds like, is very tragic circumstances. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, like everything, there are moments in life that make you step change, but I can't say it was an overnight feeling, but obviously this was sort of the ignition to really get me onto a new path. And in not in the same order, so like this is a rewriting of history, but in essence what it was the true beginning of really getting to want to know at the bottom, at the core, who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And until that point, I had basically the young guy, whippersnapper, success-ridden, but big-headed lack of knowledge of really what was important to me at the deepest level. I had attachment to extrinsic concepts like the business card, the size of the car kind of thing. And the week that I was running at the time, Redken, which is a hairdressing company owned by L'Oreal, based in New York. And the tagline was Fifth Avenue, New York City. So everything we did had the DNA, the imprint of Manhattan in it, yellow cabs, iconic landmarks and such. So if you can imagine, I arrived on into my office, beautiful office, corner office, overlooking Manhattan on the morning, that Tuesday morning at around about 7 o'clock, as I was wont. It was a beautiful morning.
And
I was looking south, and I actually saw the explosion happen in the North Tower with my own eyes.
World Trade Center in 2011.
That's exactly 2001.
Yeah.
Right. So small details. But I called my assistant who had been working there since 1993, and she said, oh my God, there's a terrorist attack. And anyway, the things play out. I have my office filled with 50 people overlooking this, crying already. Then everybody leaves, and I'm back in my office all alone. I remember calling two people, my wife and someone in Paris. And then I put that down, and I watched what was happening. And all of a sudden, I spotted a small plane. I was like, oh, I wonder what that is. And it was just curiosity at this point, you know, just didn't really think more of it. And as I got closer to the Twin Towers, I said, oh, it must be a Canadair. It's going to dump water on the fire. That's what there's. That's why it's coming. Phew. Of course, that's not what happened. Anyway, things what happened there were really the reason why it became more than just a big deal and, sadness and death and so on, is I really lent into what it was like to have been a captain of a ship at the time of Pearl Harbor. So you're captain of a ship. Mm-hmm. In the Philippines, as my grandfather was, and at 3 a.m, he was woken up by the cook on the USS Napa in Manila Bay, and the cook said, Captain, we've been attacked. And later on that day, he went back to the logbook of the USS Napa, and by hand, he wrote 0340 hours, hostilities with the Japanese Empire started, we were at war. And I had been researching this whole thing for 10 years. So it wasn't just a flippant experience for me. It was like, oh my God, this is my moment that my grandfather lived through. I was named after him. And from that moment, I flipped into, I've got to do stuff that matters and that resonates with me in the deepest level. And little by little, I say little by little because it's not something that happened like this. But that's really the moment that got me into this idea of, I have to lead myself. In order to do that, I have to know myself.
I mean, you were searching for meaning. I mean, a big event like that, I think for a lot of us, it was, you know, those events tend to trigger those types of thoughts. It's like, yeah, there's, what are we doing with our time here on Earth?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, oh, selling shampoos, not important, right?
Yeah.
Making the numbers.
No, okay.
Got to make them, but maybe there are other things which are more important than doing just that.
Right. Well, I think we all, at some point, have those thoughts. I mean, I used to think about it because I traveled extensively for years internationally, as I'm sure you did as well. And yeah, I remember being on a plane flying through a hurricane in Asia, big, 747 bouncing around like atop, thinking, oh my God, if this was to go down, how stupid, you know, I'm on a sales call. Who cares, right? That seemed like silly, right? That would be the events that led to one thing to another. And it does, you do rethink things, I think.
It's a reveille. It reminds you that life is short and that therefore it's more interesting to do things that matter. Plus the reality is we all know we have to go past that last hurdle. And so the sooner you get a grip on that, don't wait for a life-changing moment to get on it. That's sort of what my intonation is mm-hmm. you can do it without having to face death because it's just a reality. And so my hope is to just prod people or at least nudge people into this idea that life actually is short, do things that matter, which doesn't mean give up numbers and being, you know, unpragmatic. You've got to still do the business. But just put things into perspective and try to do things that matter with you personally.
Right. I mean, there's sort of this theme throughout the book is, and I think it lends to this, is that we can't bifurcate ourselves, right? That we've got this business persona, we've got this personal persona, and if they're not aligned, that's problematic. And I see that all the time, and certainly in sales, and primarily a sales audience listening to this show is a lot of people think that performing sales, they have to put on an act. You know, they have to be something that's sort of not aligned with who they are as a person, and that has huge impacts on their ability to perform because individual sellers, in many respects, they are leaders, right? I mean, you're trying to inspire a buyer to take a journey with you, much as leaders inspire employees to take journeys with them, a journey of change. And yeah, if you're, and I know the term authenticity is overused, and we'll sort of talk about that. But I mean, if it's not you, if it's an act, that's going to show to the buyer.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, basically, a salesperson has that autonomy. So with that independence comes leadership, because you're leading you and your squad of, you know, your clients, and so you have the autonomy to go to places and you're in the fire, you're in the moment doing it. So you have mm-hmm. to bring those people along. The point that I often hear is, well, it's easier if you believe in the product and service, right? If you believe in what you're selling, it's easier. If you don't believe in it, you're going to be called out for a bunch of BS. But the issue is, what do you believe in? Because you can be tempted, oh, it's a great product. The product is really great. I believe in the product. It's a perfect tool to do damage, for example. It's the best tool. I believe in its abilities to do damage. But how does that make you feel? So the point is linking in that belief actually with who you are and what do you stand for. And doing that work will make you that for a much more solid, stronger salesperson, because you're actually tapping into your person, your personality, what you believe personally.
Well, I think that's right. First and foremost, you have to believe in yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And to your point throughout the book, and we'll get into the details of that, is you have to understand what are the things that you believe in. If you want to exercise that autonomy, and I think this is one of the problems, and again, we'll get into a little bit later, is in sales these days, is there's a huge stress and emphasis on conformity. And a lot of the autonomy that traditionally sellers might have enjoyed has sort of gone by the wayside, because now through technology, you have got all this transparency into what's taking place at every step of the selling process. That we've got this push-pull. I think increasingly sellers feel like they're being pushed to sell in a way that's not aligned with who they are personally. And since I do believe, as individual sellers, fundamentally is a leadership position, that's problematic. I think we're seeing that play out in, you know, mental health issues and burnout and other things in the sales world.
It's deeply unhealthy, because at the end of the day, you're making a gap by putting on the professional mask, touting or playing to the rules that are set, but the gap between those rules, the way you are being told to operate and who you are, that over time, that creates tremendous entropy. And to compensate for that, you get more tired, Well, I just have another cup of coffee. It's okay. I'm excited right. because I got a big bonus at the end of the month. I'm excited. But what you're doing is you're drawing down on your real energy. And the only way to have that real energy lost over time, because you and I know that it's a long game, life. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least it's a long, it's more like a marathon. Of course, life is short, but in the right. act of living these lives, it's easy to lose your energy. The one that fires yeah. inside.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that this not getting too far off track here, but to that point you just made is that, yeah, you have to, I look at my career. I mean, I'm 40 years into my career, more. And yet I'm still, you know, excited about this whole field and, you know, produced 900 episodes of this podcast plus and just submitted a new manuscript for a book and for my third book. And it's like, yeah, I always feel like, yeah, I grabbed the autonomy, right? I sort of demanded that autonomy, and I did it through performance. I mean, you do have to perform if you're going to ask, make that ask.
Sure.
But yeah, I always felt like I was able to do things my way, and not that I wasn't a team player, and you know, lots of people contributed to my success, and we worked as teams, but I felt like I sort of had a vision of what it was like the way I wanted to operate. And there was just, I couldn't put that mask on. You know, I couldn't yeah. be that person that our training, certainly in the era that I came into sales, that you definitely were trained to put a mask on. I mean, you had to be that buoyant, joyous, hey, you know, hail fellow, well met type thing.
Yeah. I don't want to hear any, I've had a bad day thing, or, you know, it's always got to be good.
Yeah. You always had to be on top of it. I mean, so this idea of that you're talking about is that you, and I emphasize in all caps, uppercase letters, you lead, and who the you is you right that you think that the pandemic and COVID has encouraged more people to sort of come to grips with this idea that there needs to be sort of a unified person leading as opposed to having this professional and personal gap as you talk about?
Well, to start with, I even thought of another title, which is You Lead You. Actually, that's really
right.
what this is about. Because if you can lead mm-hmm. you, then you'll be better at leading others, assuming you even have a team.
Right.
And the reality of this pandemic has done two things. First of all, the existential crisis. We're talking about death all the time. And so that naturally feeds into our limbic system, the fear of what's going on. And mm-hmm. and like those who watched or experienced 9/11, oh my God, life is short. Can I do stuff that matters? And so there, people are then taking the time, they have more time, a lot of people, and they are sitting in their beds thinking, what am I going to get out of bed for to walk over to my desk 2.5 meters away? To do what? To do a bunch of Zoom calls? What is the importance of all this? And so there's this notion of getting into that story of what matters. Secondly, when you get to the Zoom, your home is on display. So we're no longer donning a tie, putting on a mask, and going to work. Mm-hmm. Although that could have a scary echo in another world, right? But we're basically going from our bed to our home with the cat, the kid who screams, and the sounds outside your window. And so actually, in the end of the day, we're kind of being forced, some people much more uncomfortably than others, because they don't yeah. even have separate spaces, privacies that some other people are afforded. And a lot of bosses who might have the 2 houses, 6 cars, and, you know, whatever, need to lean in with empathy on others who might not have the same kind of conditions, whether it's marital bliss or a beautiful home with 3 different rooms that you can hide off in if you need to. And so this notion of actually work and personal life have merged in this pandemic. And I think that's a good thing because it's waking people up to the fact that being 2 different people is bad news.
I wonder how many leaders, though, and I'm interested in your assessment of this, are really sort of embracing that. And because, yeah, I find that in interviewing hundreds of people a year for this podcast and many leaders, and over the last 12 months, and also you know, reading lots of things on LinkedIn, how initially there was sort of this, oh, yeah, 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 we need to be much more empathetic now, you know, back in March, April, a year ago, you know, as if it was like a revelation, oh, we need to lead with empathy. But a lot of that's just gone away.
Well,
I wonder to what degree leaders and corporations have really embraced this change. I think the individual contributors certainly have to a greater degree because it seems like more of a reality to them. But I just wonder how much the leaders really have because there's very little talk about it.
Well, I tend to agree. I think that right now there are several things that are going against us. The first is general fatigue. And when you're not taking care of your own energies, how can you be good with others? And so a lot of bosses, I believe, are absolutely fatigued by what's going on. They've been taught for 40 years to say, I'm always good. All right, so come on.
Right.
We got to do this. I got this.
Yeah, we got
this. Yeah, right. So, but they've actually not lent into who they are and what they feel. And so they're actually running on fumes. And so they start losing the plot with regard to the patience, the generosity, the ear to actually hear other people. Because actually we're all on this boat together. But because they're not actually leaning into it, then they're not going to have that graciousness to listen to other people's stories and connect in. Because you have to operate differently when all you have is this screen. The second thing is a stress of performance. Because there are, albeit some companies that are doing well, but I think as we come out of this, despite packages, which, you know, obviously some countries have more than others, that the government might be laying out, I think a lot of people are going to be under a lot of stress, not just from because of change, but actually because of the numbers. And as soon as you start throwing in stress, then you're going to start doing shortcuts and you're going to forget to take the effort, which is what it takes to listen to people. It takes effort to be polite. It takes effort to have empathy. And if you don't know why you're doing it, then you just cut short corners and you just go, come on, shape up, come on. And it comes too quickly.
Yeah, well, I mean, you refer to that in the book. You're talking about companies that fall back too quickly into this whole idea of the sort of rational and financial drivers of the business will be the ones that struggle. But I'm already seeing indications of companies sort of defaulting to that. I mean, an example in the sales world is somebody had done a survey, last fall, maybe last summer, and the results came out in the fall, that CFOs of large corporations have seen these tremendous sort of savings on travel and entertainment for their sales teams because they haven't been on the field, they haven't been making sales calls. And they're like, great, let's cut budgets. And it's like, why, right? I mean, what makes you think that's going to work? What makes you think what was happening this last year when everybody was pulling together was going to be sustainable? And to your point about not listening to customers.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is all have issues. And so really at the end of the day, the issues of the pandemic per se, do you have a vaccination? Are you wearing masks? And do you know anybody who's sick? These are real issues that anybody can be facing. And at some level, it's not possible to gloss over them. So what I think we really need, so I was mentioning offices, we have to understand that not having offices is not just a cost saving. It's a total shift in mindset. So if we're focusing just on the cost saving and we're not doing the adjustments necessary to make remote work, which means not operating in the same way, really leaning into how do you build trust, because that just doesn't happen at a flick of the wrist.
Right.
And we're gonna need to adapt to the way we work. So we can't just have back-to-back meetings like we always do. Oh, it's really efficient. Yeah, but people actually need to pee. People need to take a break. So are you enforcing that sort of maximum, come on, we've got to do this. We got to break it in, get the month in. Whereas this is a lot, you've got to think long-term as well. And what is the legacy you want to be creating as a leader? Do you want to just be the guy who makes the number? Or do you want to be a guy or a woman who's able to be noble and pull up everybody and make it bigger. And in sales in particular, it's so easy to get reduced down to the numbers, the bonuses, the numbers you got to reach, the things you got to tick, the boxes, the processes and all that.
And instead
focus on what is the purpose of your organization? Is everybody in your sales team understanding how your company, your services or products, whatever they are making the world or some community a better place? Because everyone started off from that position. So if you can mobilize your sales team to know that it's not just about bringing the number, but doing something of a greater magnitude, it doesn't have to be like Mother Teresa-like, but just something that's bigger than just getting in the number and making the shareholder happy, then it's kind of a mechanical process of burning out. Because otherwise it's just a sales team, because what happens in January next year, you have to be January of this year. And it's just an ongoing, it was a bad month, you get a better comparison, but then that's just the only race in town.
Well, I think it's such a great point, because like there's so many companies that and the people within the company that can't clearly express what that bigger purpose is. And it comes across, it's part of your messaging. It's part of the branding. You talk about branding in the book, somewhat personal, the importance of personal branding, which I want to get to. But this is part of the branding.
Yeah. And it's the responsibility of marketers to help understand what that brand's about and work with the sales team to understand it, to express it. And then we're talking about that sort of notion of process and the homogenization mm-hmm. of the sales team. I think it's very appropriate to think of this notion of the paradox between belonging to a tribe, so like a team where you wear a uniform, but allowing the expression of the individual. That's a really important paradox that we should be allowing for.
Yeah, and I think that's your paradox number one of your four paradoxes of leadership is need to belong yet be different. But that's so hard these days for managers to do. And I think part of it is because we've become increasingly driven by the KPIs and by the metrics. And people operate from a sense of fear. And it's hard to say, look, I'm going to enable Jennifer to express herself, to do her thing, to give her this autonomy that, the same metrics we expect everybody else, we're not going to expect of Jennifer because maybe she's going to perform. And I find managers find that extremely difficult because it's different, right? They got the numbers. I can look at the metrics. I can take comfort in the metrics. Jennifer's not making enough calls. Doesn't matter if she's selling enough, right? I mean, I've had people come on the show and talk about, well, you've got somebody who's a top performer, but they're not hitting the activity metrics that you'd put as a standard, then they should get rid of them because they're not a culture fit. And it's like, well, what is your culture at that point then? If you can't embrace people operating autonomously to achieve the outcomes that you want, what sort of organization do you have at that point?
Well, clearly there need to be some processes and rules, obviously ethics and so on. But the issue is that this is a long-term adjustment. You don't do this overnight. And if you haven't hired for the attitudes in the first place and you've inherited a team that is not of the ilk and the variety that you want, you can't just sort of fire them all or get them all to change overnight. It's a long-term thing. So if you're in that position, then what you're going to need to do is understand what is the story, start figuring out what type of behaviors, language are going to make your tribe work, because you need to make it work, but also make them feel that they belong. And then establish the parameters and the freedoms, the agency, to allow them. So ethics, the way we ruled, is our governance is this way. We consider this inappropriate, but anything underneath that is good. So yours to invite freedom of creativity, initiative, and so on.
Well, you use an interesting phrase in the book, which I cut and paste it up, probably go on a social post of mine at some point, is you said there's no identity without differentiation. And we're not trying to make everybody be the same as everybody else. I think, though, there are some managers that, you know, there's tools that exist that you can sort of try to do that. And they take some comfort because I think it's easy just to have a cookie cutter approach to this, where, to your point throughout the book, is that increasingly the buying experience, the customer experience, is based on how they experience the individual, not the brand identity of the company.
Well, there's an enormous amount of mediocrity. And within mediocrity is average, and average is not stand out. And so if you aren't prepared to stand out, and you need to push that envelope further in order to be able to push and hopefully allow more people in your organization to re-present your point of difference, then you are bound to fall back into, oh, I need to sell everything to everybody because I'm so inclusive that I want any customer. Well,
right.
That's just not a good place to be.
No.
It might sound nice, but the problem with belonging is it also means I don't belong or you don't belong. There is a border. If you and I are members are fans of the great football team, the right football team, well, the other ones are the wrong football teams. The less.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. So Manchester United is not a topic of conversation. Liverpool is. So that means that I am being exclusionary. Therefore, at some level, I mean, I have Man U fans, right? So, but that's okay. I'll survive. But we have within that belongingness an exclusion, and that's somehow our challenge. Because if I belong to this perimetered group, then I don't want these clients. Oh, but you know, they could be $100,000 contract, right? But then you're diluting what you stand for, and it's to have those strong arguments. So this is not something you do overnight because you're not going to jettison all the clients that don't stand for what you want to stand for. But you move towards it. But you can't do it if you don't know what you stand for in the first place.
Yeah, and you talk about this in the book. You refer to it as sort of a North Star. So how do leaders, we'll start with leaders, but I mean, how do you define this North Star? Because it speaks to a little bit what we talked about before is that, in the absence of this North Star, you're just sort of flailing and will expend all of your energy. You will burn out. You will not achieve what you want to achieve.
So the first and most important North Star is your own personal one, because anyway, you lead you. So what does this mean? Well, many people might have come across the term, but 99% of people do not have what's necessary, which is a precise personal North Star. It's generally a North Star that's a little bit vague. And by having a vague one, well, that's great. Yeah, I generally know this is what I want. I want to be happy. I want to be healthy. Want to have family or these generic ideas.
Financial security, right?
For example. But what we need to have is a much more precise one that doesn't have to be the exact North, but a precise one to you that speaks to you. So that what does that mean? Well, that means that I have a vision of the person I want to be in a far distant future. Or I mean, so 20 years from now or 15 years from now, whatever. Who do I want to be? And in that, it's not what do I want to do? It's who do I want to be? And if you need to zero in on that with like tenacity in order to focus on that and not slip into, well, I want to, run a company.
Oh. Right.
Why do you want to run? Because I want to be this type of person. And then the second thing is step into your values. And the thing about values, there are roughly 75 of them. It's very simple and easy to want to like all of them. Oh, I like integrity. Oh, I'm into love, family, innovation. There are so many. I mean, who wouldn't want all of them? But the hard work, like strategy, is actually being selective. And then once you've got your real values, then you need to break them down into a code so that you understand that these are the type of behaviors that represent these values. So when you do that for yourself as a leader, then you can start thinking about the same thing in a strong way with regard to your company or the brand you're running. because all of a sudden it sort of now resonates within you. Because what you want is that resonance to happen in other people, that vibration. That's so it, so every the CFO included gets that feeling. And then when you have then you have a real brand that's going to have lungs and air and organic feelings and excitement. And that's where you really start get pulsating and make a long-term durable brand.
Right. And to the point I was making before is in the eyes of your buyer, individual seller that's working on their account, they represent that brand. I mean, research has shown that you know, in excess of 50% of a buyer's purchase decision is based on their experience with the seller in this process. So to the degree that the leaders need to have the North Star, sellers do as well.
Absolutely. Well,
right? I mean,
100%. It's the same thing. But if you're a leader, like a sales manager, and you have five people in your team, you need to do it on yourself first.
Yes.
Don't start preaching about it unless you've done the work yourself. So this is a little bit of a longer term game. And the issue is so many of us kind of rationalize that we think we got it, you know, because we're intelligent people where we can come up with the words, especially salespeople, right? You know, I got the chatch. But actually what it takes is leaning into, for example, your imperfections, your dark side. And I don't then say you need to be transparent about that, but you need to be realistic about it to yourself. And once you have that self-awareness and your honesty with what you are as an individual, then things start becoming a little bit more, less of a battle. So many of these bad managers and people who don't know how to lead is that they have some unresolved issues and they start taking it out on people. They're not prepared to listen and learn because they've got this other issue, which is breaking them down and making them feel less human or less generous with others.
Yeah, well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think when we one of the big issues in sales these days is and it's been for some time, but it's going through its period of lots of attention is lack of coaching, right? Is generally, we do a relatively poor job of training our salespeople. It's not the content, it's sort of the methods we use to train them. But what we find is really effective to help perform or improve performance is effective coaching, right? The one-on-one time. And yet for way too many managers, that one-on-one time is all about being more directive, right? So what are you doing on this deal? What are you doing on this? As opposed to, what do you want to achieve, right? What are the things that are most important to you? How can I, what's the fastest way I can help you achieve what you want to achieve? That part still is largely missing. And yeah, it all works together, right? If that's missing, then you wonder, well, why? Why are salespeople churning so fast on their jobs, right? Why are they, you know, in the Valley, it's like 14 months, you know, turnover. Sales leaders, it's like 18 months now, average tenure. I mean, not the only reasons, but this is certainly part of it that contributes to it.
I totally agree. And just like, I mean, I talk about the inside out model. You ought to consider treating your employees, your teams, in the way that you'd like to treat your customers. So, I mean, the next step is actually also, as a salesperson, say to the client, hey, what are your dreams? What are your aspirations? Mm-hmm. How can I solve and participate in that? Oh, and by the way, after that, talk to you about flogging your product or service. But focus, right? I mean, obviously, I use a derogatory term, but if you can get to the bigger picture and find how you can be of service to solve their problems within a realistic scope. I mean, when I ran Redken, I just, it was so extraordinary to have that opening because I mean, I didn't, it was a gift to me. But when you understand that the role of Redken that we gave ourselves, our North Star, was to help our hairdressers, so B2B, earn a better living, live a better life.
Okay.
So make money, because 90% of hairdressers basically run at zero or loss. So it's good if our customers survive. Because if you don't survive, you got nothing to live for. There's no purpose to a bankruptcy. I mean, there is, but not a good one. And then the second thing is live a better life. Because why is that important? Because hairdressers are an essential element, piece of the community. And the 1,200 customers in general that they serve, they are making those 1,200 people feel better. So our role was to help them feel better. And there's a big difference between self-confidence and self-belief. And the things that we tried to focus on at Redken was that if you have stronger self-belief, then you're going to feel better about yourself. You're going to live a better life. Having the competency is how you get to earn more money, generally.
Right.
But the belief is how you live a better life.
How did you help then your customers achieve those two things?
Right. Well, there's a whole strategy to this, but the key component of it, well, first of all, it was an entire company-wide concept. We overinvested by three times what anyone else in the industry was doing in what was called education. So the education is how to help a hairdresser do their business. Mm-hmm. And whereas the standard was one third less in terms of education, where they would focus generally on how to make the products well used. Because if you screw up a hair color, that's bad news. But how about you make the person who's doing the hair color feel better about themselves? So we would introduce things which are far more personal. Like, you know, what's your financial hygiene? Are you managing your own personal bank accounts well? Because if you're worried about the credit card debts you have while you're cutting someone else's hair, how does that make you feel good?
Yeah, huge stressor.
Right? Amongst others. And so we would allow ourselves to go in and talk at a personal level. So in order for that to happen, you need to create a whole level of trust for them to share with you what their real issues are. And then once you have that trust, then you got to come to the table with things that can help them. And I mean, we had this marvelous lady. She still actually works in part for Redken. Her name was Anne Mincy. And when I was working at Redken and running it, she wasn't officially called this because people at L'Oreal would have looked at me a little bit crazy, but we called her the unofficial director of love. So her role was to give love out. How beautiful is that? Modeling love in a corporate environment. You're probably thinking inside, if you're listening to this, Mentor, this guy is seriously crazy. Well, it was seriously beautiful. Whenever you were in Anne's presence, you felt like the single most important person in the world. And she made me do this. She made everybody she was with do this. And when that happens, it starts rubbing off onto other people. So you had little mini directors of love, if you will, after that, you know, other people who get into that spirit. And so these are the different types of things. I can't give an ROI on this stuff. If I'm down to a metric, what is this? And so many of these soft skills are non-measurable, like empathy. You can't measure empathy.
Yeah, somebody told me a while ago, I adopted this term is we need to stop calling them soft skills, call them power skills.
Yeah, totally.
Because they really are the power behind the connection you can make with somebody and the impact you're going to have on someone. I didn't mean to interrupt your flow of thought, but I just thought you might enjoy that because I think this person is absolutely right.
Well, but my book before this was called Artificial Empathy.
Yes.
And so I've been very much invested in this concept of empathy. And so I even have these two drawings in it of the superpowers of empathy and how they really are supremely powerful. Yet they are, as we said at the very beginning, everybody knows it, but actually we don't do it. And the issue with it is it has to be very intentional and it takes time. And so you need to plan it out to listen to people and ask people open questions and have the ear to listen deeply.
Yeah, we've tried to package up empathy, right? Yeah. I mean, in marketing these days, you know, and it's useful to have a persona, a description of your customer, but unfortunately, it's oftentimes used as, oh, I understand this person now, right? I've got empathy for them because I've read this two-paragraph description of who they are and what they care about and what's important to them and so on. And yeah, I mean, I'm I hadn't read that book of yours, but I suspect you're sort of on the same path empathy is hugely important, but I think that everybody sort of defaults to this compassionate empathy as opposed to the cognitive empathy, which is...
Absolutely.
I can certainly feel, if you read Paul Bloom's book, Against Empathy, but...
I went to Yale.
Yeah, okay. So it's not enough just to feel what they feel. You need to understand why people feel the way they do. To your point, you need to listen. You need to ask open-ended questions. You need to understand. And then you can communicate that love as Anne was doing.
Well, I love how you talked about the TTB, the tick the box type of empathy, put it in a package. Mm-hmm. And actually what I wanted to do with artificial empathy was tap into this desire. Oh, great. You know what, Andy? All we need to do is buddy make the AI empathic and then we're good. We're off the hook.
Yeah. Good luck on that, by the way. But yes.
So what I did is I imagined that thought and then I wind back and say, actually, it doesn't work that way. You need to be inside out empathic. You need to treat your salespeople with empathy. Understand them. What's their personal story? What are their personal ambitions? And then allow for that to happen. So they might even stay for more than 14 months, because if you're allowing them to achieve their life ambition, mm-hmm. Well, of course they're going to stay with you.
Yes.
And by the way, if they then can, once they feel that for real, mm-hmm. It can't be some sort of ingenious little ploy, 2-week ploy. It's got to be seeping into the entire organization. Then they can deploy empathy to their customers.
Right.
And then when the customer has something to deal with, when the salesperson goes back to, it's an issue that maybe he or she couldn't resolve at the coal mine, but they can go back and talk to somebody, hey, listen, we need to adapt something. And the marketing person says, oh, okay, that's cool. Instead of not possible, не possible, mm-hmm. as the Russians might say.
Right. Yeah, what I was thinking about this the other day in context of another conversation I was preparing for is this whole idea of understanding driving empathy is do you remember Harvey McKay wrote books, Swimming with Sharks, and famous New York Times bestselling author. I think he's 92 years old now. I had him on the show a couple years ago, still
nice.
I think he was 89 or 90 at the time, still sharp as a tack. But he talked about in his business and that he ran outside his consulting business, that ran an envelope company. But his salespeople, they required them to had a list of 65 things they needed to understand about their buyers. And it was, it wasn't all just what business needs. It's, what are they like as a person? How would you describe them? What's important to them? Some deeply personal stuff as well. And I thought, with that type of framework, 65 things, you understand what their concerns are. You understand why they feel the way they do, and I was thinking this in terms of our conversation today, it's like, as a leader, how many things should you know about your employees, right?
It's awfully 60, complicated because...
Are there 65 topics you should know the answer to? That's possibly true.
Oh, sure. I mean, the challenge is knowing where the cursor needs to go.
Right.
Because we have, I like to put down these three parts to us. The professional part, like you have the competencies to do mm-hmm. this. Are you an extrovert or an introvert right. or whatever? Like competencies, professional. And then you have the intimate side of you, your private side, your secret garden. Yeah. And we all have that, and we right. need to have that. And yes. I like to say there is beauty and mystery, and protect that. That's great. But then you have this whole thing in the middle, which is the personal stuff: what team you support, what's important to you, your values, your ethics. Right? These are the of the domain that personal, and in order to get those 65 points, you have to obviously be plowing down into the personal side. The question is, how far do you go? And in a world where we have so many HR issues and boundaries and lawsuits right. that can come up and bite you in the bum, you need to be careful about that. You need to be strategic. Exactly. Like back in my days, we had a policy, Andy, of allowing hugs, but not just like tap, tap, you know, hug stuff. 7-second hugs.
Was this like part of a sales meeting or something?
Every type of meeting we obviously we didn't do it all the time, but it was part of our signature way of greeting people. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you why. Man to man, woman to woman, and man to woman. Mm-hmm. Because when you do long hugs, it turns out that your hearts start to synchronize.
Right.
Well, if that's not a personal idea, then, you know, but you can't just do that overnight. You don't just, you know, invent this because A, you'll have lots of lawsuits coming on you, and P, you may not have people who are comfortable doing that. So you need to, craft this into your program. If you're a legacy company, you've been around for 20 years, and all of a sudden you come in, the boss say, I want to just start hugging. Well, good luck.
Right. As you said, lots of meetings with HR about that.
Yep. I'm going to move away from there. Move away, yeah, son. Right.
Yeah. I'm not comfortable with that. Well, the last thing I just want to talk about, though, too, is your third paradox, which was we must reconcile the quest for order in the presence of chaos. And interesting, you'd written that you know, change is an instigator of disorder. And I sort of look at it as the other way is true as well, right? Disorder is an instigator of change itself. Hmm. And they both work. Right, the instigators of change, but I mean,
that feels right.
This idea of chaos is, yeah. I think one of the things we're trying to do with technology is we're trying to tamp down the chaos. Right, we're trying to say everything can be driven by data or informed by data, and it's very orderly. And the fact is, it's not. And what we're doing with that isn't making it more orderly, and you just sort of. Looting yourself if you think it does. I mean, this idea that for me with chaos, and I've heard this early in my career, listening to a lecturer talk about the key skill he believed for success in the world, in life, not just business, was a tolerance of ambiguity. Mm. And you really need to have that in the midst of chaos. And I think people are running into trouble because they're trying to make the world more orderly than it really is. And maybe this has gone on forever with mankind. It probably has. But it seems to be more acute now. But one of the things that's happening is that it's, at least in sales, what I see is, this widening gap between the buyer's behaviors in terms of how they gather information to make decisions and what the process that sellers use, whereas sellers want to think it's things are very sort of serial, orderly process. And Gartner done research a few years ago about buyer's process, and it's this, what I call it, the spaghetti diagram, because it's this hugely confusing mass of trails and flows and processes and recursive events and so on going on that was the epitome of chaos.
What you need to do is talk to a neuroscientist.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at the way the brain functions. So the notion of ambiguity for me, Andy, speaks more to the notion of paradoxes and how we have to live without comfort. We have to live between mm-hmm. opposing forces, which can be marketing and sales, of course. But in general, this notion of ambiguity, we're never going to know everything. And
right.
and for me, the way I've explored this, because I certainly haven't come up with all of these thoughts, but it has been man's ambition, very much a masculine ambition, to want to codify the world. Give everything a label, put it in a box, and that renders it safe. And then all of a sudden, you've got this sort of individual that wants to say, no, but I'm different. Because it's back to the notion of belonging and feeling different,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
You can codify everybody, but if everybody in the army is the same, then there's nobody place for the personality, and you're going to lobotomize everybody. So things like creativity, intuition, imagination, emotions, relationship, and then further on into things like empathy. It's messy. Mm-hmm. And there is, we need to allow for that. That is part of our condition. I mean, I've looked at astrophysics from an arm's length because I'm a literary guy. So I think I got a C in physics, but mm-hmm. in astrophysics, this notion of chaos is a part of it. And so what, like serendipity in our lives, we need to allow for chaos. And so
yep.
practically speaking, what does that mean? That it means you kind of need to plan for the unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because the unexpected is kind of expectedly going to arrive. Like shit happens. Mm-hmm. A traffic jam that you didn't plan can happen. An accident. You know, shit does happen. So this is sort of like the more prosaic version of chaos. And therefore, you need to allow for it. So if you don't allow for serendipity, that means you're just rushing from one meeting to another. No air time for your brain to just think differently. You know, mm-hmm. the equivalent of a shower, if you will, then you're going to have very average thoughts. So you need to allow for the chaos. And that means knowing that you have kind of processes, but you also have gaps that allow for agency and autonomy.
Exactly, which I think is the critical part, at least in sales is, you know, I don't look at sales as this linear process as much as it's a collection of moments. And the moments may be unexpected, the moments may not happen at the time you expect, but if you're prepared for the unexpected, as you talked about, you're going to seize the opportunity more effectively than anybody else.
Another thing that's important about, especially, it was certainly the way I lived sales, was that you are operating, I worked in the hairdressing industry, so you had the binome of the salesperson with the educator, mm-hmm. and that was a super important one. The other persons that are important were customer service,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it needs to be service. You need to have an organizational process to allow for this. So, because if you have, you know, comments like, oh, you know, Andy, he's the, you know, the firecracker. He's always doing this, breaking the rules. That kind of comment's not really wholesome. So mm-hmm. You have to be able to allow for a system-wide where customer service also understands what the purpose of the organization is. The educator mm-hmm. is doing it the same way. And you also then you have to unify and be smart about how you set down objectives and remuneration, because we also do operate that way. That's a very human instinct. So right. you need to be smart about how you set the objectives, the team-wide. And I mean, so it's not easy to do it. But if you can make sure that everybody's tapped into the story, the purpose of your organization, from customer service to CEO to CFO, right. HR and so on, then you have a better chance of making super happy customers.
Love it. All right. Well, Minter, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but this has been great. Thank you very much for joining me.
It's been my great pleasure, Andy. I appreciate it very much. I love the fact that we can connect from San Diego to London and like the Reds.
And like the Reds. Unfortunately, they're not doing very well this year, but nope. They've been hammered by injuries like no one else has been. So,
yeah, I agree with that.
Lose the core of your defense, and
but that's our journey. You know, that's
our
journey.
That's our journey. Yes.
Yeah, because if we just wanted to, you know, always like the best team, then that says legions about you.
That's right. So, all right. Well, Minter, thank you so much. And if people want to connect with you, what's the best way to connect with you?
Well, I have a Google-friendly name, MinterDial.com, and I'm on where I blog, and I have a podcast, Minter Dialogue, and otherwise I have a
clever.
Like that? And I have MDial, M-D-I-A-L, on various social channels, and love to connect.
All right. Minter, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Andy.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. I'm ever so grateful for your support of the show. And I want to thank my guest, Minter Dial, for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you could also leave us a rating or a review and let us know how we're doing, well, we'd appreciate it. And you can do all that on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this episode is over. So thank you for your help. And thank you so much, as always, for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales. We're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.